Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your alienation effect of music news and criticism. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
Every man has a black star over his shoulder. And when a man sees his black star, he knows his time has come. Black star, don't shine on me, black star. Black star, keep behind me, black star.
That's a song by Elvis Presley called Black Star, and it was brought to my attention by our guest today, Simon Critchley. Hi, Simon.
Hi.
Who is a philosopher and a writer and wrote a book about David Bowie a couple of years ago, which we'll get to in a second. But the subject today is love and death regarding David Bowie and his work. But the Elvis Presley song, Black Star... This was sent to you by a friend in England. This has not been noticed that widely, as far as I can tell, by poking around on the internet. Do you think that people are beginning to understand this song as one of the, you know, final clues around Bowie's death or one of his, you know, messages?
I think it must be a clue. I mean, you know, he liked Elvis. Everybody liked Elvis.
Sure.
It wasn't a song that was released.
No.
It's clear in the song that, you know, everyone's born under a black star, and that black star is death. So the album is under the sign of death, and so the reference to the allusion to Elvis kind of makes that pretty clear.
The song Black Star by Elvis is an alternate take. It wasn't released until the 90s, I think. It was done for a film called Flaming Star. The version that people know is the song called Flaming Star, which has slightly different words, you know, slightly altered. But this was the first draft, the first version. Maybe it was too spooky. I don't know.
Too dark, too black.
Flaming, this is very lazy of me, but there's no time to do anything. I haven't seen the film Flaming Star in the period since you sent me that email and where we are now.
I've never seen it.
So I'm going to read from Wikipedia. Flaming Star is a 1960 Western film starring Elvis Presley and Barbara Eden. Elvis Presley plays Pacer Burton, the son of a Kiowa mother and a Texan father working as a rancher. His family lives a typical life on the Texan frontier. Life becomes anything but typical when a nearby tribe of Kiowa begin raiding neighboring homesteads. Pacer, the Elvis Presley character, soon finds himself caught between the two worlds, part of both but belonging to neither. That's kind of a Bowie concept, no?
Yeah, part of both and belonging to neither.
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to figure out why his interest in the figure of Lazarus and the interest in the figure of Lazarus, the fact that Lazarus is the name of the theater show, the musical show in New York at the moment that's done, you know, very good box office. I've seen it a couple of times, but why the Thomas Jerome Newton character, why the man who fell to earth, what is it about, what's going on there? And Thomas Jerome Newton, whom Bowie plays and then in a sense plays him, is sort of indistinguishable for us, Thomas Jerome Newton and Bowie, is someone who cannot die. And so the Lazarus, the play, is basically the continuation of that story. He's in an apartment in New York and he can't die. So he just looks young and he's chained to life. And the Lazarus character, I mean, in John's gospel, I was discussing this morning with the writer Rick Moody, who's also a Bowie fan, and we were just knocking this back and forth. He's thinking about it. I mean, Lazarus was raised from the dead by Jesus, and we tend to see the story from Jesus' perspective or from the two sisters, Mary and Martha, who were friends of Jesus, who say, "Can you help our brother?" Nobody asked Lazarus how he feels. And Lazarus is brought back after 4 days dead, stinking. He's described as stinking. And also he's covered, he's described as being wrapped in cloths, and his face is covered with a cloth. And in the Lazarus video that Bowie did, his face is covered with a cloth. And in Black Star, his face is covered with a cloth. This, you know, so in a sense, he's wrapped in a shroud, but in the guise of a figure who cannot die, or a guise of a figure who's brought back from the dead, who kind of hovers between life and death. And so that's just set me thinking, I mean, Bowie's dead, and you know, it's very, very sad and all of that. The outpouring of emotion and all the rest is powerfully felt and important. But why would focus on this figure of someone who's between life and death? I was thinking, you know, I was just reading the other day, Saturday, apropos of nothing, Kafka's story, Hunter Gracchus.
Mm-hmm.
And Kafka tells this story, again, it's not clear why he tells this story, but the Hunter Gracchus is someone that's been, who died. He fell off a precipice chasing after a caribou in the Black Forest, as he says 20 times in this short story. The boat that's taking him to death takes the wrong turning and he's chained to life.
Right.
So Bowie has died, but what Bowie has done is to kind of hover between life and death,
right,
between two worlds. And that's always been the space that he's occupied. It's not as if, to that extent, his death isn't exactly news. He's always occupied that space.
This brings me to my next question, which mm-hmm. is that there was this amazing effect after he died mm-hmm. of people had heard the record, which came out 2 days before. He died on Sunday. The record came out the preceding Friday. People had heard the record, processed it, understood it as, you know, kind of dark, but, you know, basically a Bowie record. And then he died and they said, oh my God, this was a message. He was telling us something.
Yes.
Pointedly, he was telling us something. And that changed everybody's understanding of the record. But at the same time, it was another Bowie record. This is probably obvious to anybody who's paid attention to the words in his songs through the years, but death was his big theme.
Yes.
He may have said that, I don't know. I have heard him say that alienation was his big theme. And certainly that's what critics tend to say.
Yeah.
I wonder about that because isn't alienation kind of it's kind of an intellectual construct. If you take one step back from the idea of alienation, you've got something maybe mm-hmm. a bit more real. Maybe you've got death.
I think that's what you're saying is right. I was listening yesterday to a segment from a BBC interview from 2003 where he's asked about aging. The interviewer doesn't quite hear what he's saying and he has to repeat it. He says, look, aging doesn't bother me. Getting older doesn't bother me at all. Sure, if I can't, you know, move on stage, that's going to be a problem. But death, that troubles me. Death, that's the big one. The fact that I won't be here, that's something which puzzles him. And that was interesting. And then if you think about the first hit, Space Odyssey, it's not about alienation. It's about a spaceman, Major Tom, going into space and dying or committing some act of possible suicide. Mm. And that theme of a kind of chosen death, rock and roll suicide, it's all the way through his work. It's also something I was the last couple of days have been a bit of a blur of just looking at things and connecting with Bowie, but he's talking about writing the lyrics to the track Sunday, which is the opening track on Heathen, which begins with this line, nothing remains. Mm-hmm. And he talks about recording this upstate somewhere and the words just tumbling out of him. And they're very kind of, you know, bleak words at one level. And him saying in response that I didn't want to say this. This wasn't something I wanted to say, it's just something that I said. So I think with his work, if you look at the work, there are things which are contrived, which he's wanted to say, but death has tumbled out of him, maybe unwittingly for 4 decades.
Right.
And
right.
So to that extent, Black Star is, you know, a departure, an innovation and all the rest, but it's also in complete continuity with his body of work, it seems to me.
Well, from Black Star, let's hear a little bit of the final track, which is one of the songs that a lot of mm-hmm. people have seized on, called I Can't Give Everything Away.
Seeing more and feeling less, saying no but meaning yes, this is all I ever meant, that's the message that I sent. I can't give everything, everything. Away.
That's I Can't Give Everything Away from Black Star David Bowie's final record. Simon, you were just relating this to Rock and Roll Suicide, the song from Ziggy Stardust. That is one of the examples in his earlier work of the death of the narrator.
Yeah.
In your book, which came out a couple of years ago, called Bowie, everybody should read it, you talk about rock and roll suicide, both in terms of that kind of thing, the death of the narrator, but also in terms of love, a message of love, not a message of bleakness, not a message of, erasure, but of love. And that is also the subject of a piece that you wrote for the Times Online for the Opinionator blog about Bowie and the idea of love. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Let's begin with rock and roll suicide. I mean, that, you know, time takes a cigarette, puts it in your mouth, and this picture of the death of the narrator, the protagonist, Ziggy Stardust, who then dies, you know, on stage a little bit later. But the final moment of the chorus there is this, you know, oh no, love, you're not alone.
Yeah.
No matter what or who you're saying, but all the lies that lacerate your brain, I've had my share, I'll help you with the pain.
Yeah.
You're not alone.
Yeah.
And just reach out your hands. Reach out your hands. One, and then you get this refrain, wonderful. And I think what people, and I can feel it now in my body, the kind of tingle of that, that there's this rigorous, disciplined, whatever word we want to call it, bleakness in Bowie, which we could talk about. But what subtends that, what's driving that is this tenderness, this holding out of hands, this sense that you're not alone, that there's someone who understands. And Bowie was that. In his music, I feel it's marked by an intense yearning, for love. Often in the form of an appeal. I think one coupling that makes a lot of sense to me is Sound and Vision, which people know, and they might not know in the best version, but the version on Low is the best version.
Yeah.
Pale Blinds, Drawn All Day, Nothing to Do, Nothing to Say, that kind of picture of isolation and bleakness. But the next track's called Be My Wife. And the Be My Wife is a demand. Please be my wife. Stay with me. Be my wife. And those two things, for me, always go together in Bowie. The kind of sense of isolation, the sense of death, if you like, and that appeal for something else. There's a song called 5:15, Angels Have Gone, from Heathen, a track called Survive from Hours, both of which are stagings of memories of possible love or regret over something that didn't quite happen. So his music, for me, is really powerfully animated by a yearning for love, which is not sentimental. It's kind of visceral.
Mm-hmm.
It's physical. I mean, very physical. You know, there's a lot of sex in Bowie, a lot of sex. And he was a very sexual being, clearly. So there's a kind of, you know, intense longing for connection, which is also going back to the Lazarus play. That's what it's all about. The play is about the Thomas Jerome Newton character's fantasies of this character Mary Lou from the film, this, you know, woman who's working as a chambermaid in the hotel in New Mexico that Thomas Jerome Newton turns up at, and it's memories of her and his love for her.
Right.
So there's always that sense of that need for love. Heroes, too, is another example of that.
So it's not just I'm in exile and I'm not like you and I am the other.
It's not Kurt Cobain under the bridge so much.
Yeah.
It's not just that.
It may be I'm from another place or I'm stateless or but I need to connect with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, about, you know, the very first song he recorded as David Bowie, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And the narrative is, it's a bit mysterious. It's a guy who's done something wrong, and he's blackened the family name.
Right.
And he has to go. But the whole thing is sort of like, I have to go. You're not going to see me anymore, but I'm thinking about you. He wants to connect.
It's that connection and disappearance with Bowie. It's always the two things which are linked. And that's, I mean, how they're linked, I don't know, but they are linked. I mean, again, going back to Heroes, it's that, you know, me, I'll drink all the time, all those lines about the isolation.
Yeah.
But he's looking at, what he's thinking about is the image of the two lovers on the wall kissing. And that moment, that epiphany of watching those two lovers embrace in a world which is loveless and dead. Mm-hmm. And so you've got this world that's loveless and dead. You've got this figure who's isolated from it, yearning for something, yearning for some connection. That kind of drama plays out in song after song.
Talking about rock and roll suicide again, you're English. You were telling me before we started today that you were 12.
12, yeah.
When you heard the Starman single,
yep,
from Ziggy Stardust.
July 6, 1972.
Aha. When you heard the album and you heard the song Rock and Roll Suicide and you heard that appeal.
Mm. So he picked on you, who, yeah. And he points his finger at that. He points and he's pointing at me. It's yeah. me. Dave is pointing at me.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you heard that appeal, you're not alone.
Yeah.
Did you get that from any other force in popular culture or music, such a direct appeal? Like, this is for you.
No, I mean, I can think of things that approximate to it, and I can think of things that echo it.
Yeah.
Imitate it. But no, there's something about the kind of, it's libidinous, and it's not just libidinous, it's about love, and it's directed to you, and you can give me your hands,
yeah.
you know, you're wonderful.
Yeah.
You can be pulled out of this in relationship to this character. And also what's interesting, but we were talking before about Bowie's enduring popularity as a progenitor, as a precursor for, you know, queer culture and all the rest. And all of that is absolutely true.
Yeah.
Bowie is incredibly germane to so much that's gone on in the last decades. And that's great. But there was something back then mysterious about Bowie's sexuality. It wasn't as if he was queer or he was gay or he was not gay. He was just a kind of an enigma,
yeah.
a kind of a cipher of desire who was making an appeal to you.
Yeah.
He didn't quite know where it was coming from or what it meant.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if he was a gay man saying, you know, here I am, sing if you're glad to be gay, like Tom Robinson a few years later. That was
right.
That was clear. Bowie's desire was always much more of a kind of cipher and much more alluring and menacing at the same time.
Bisexual was the term that he used for a while. Last night, looking on YouTube, I found that somebody made a collection of video interview clips, where in each case the interviewer says, "So you have admitted that you are bisexual."
I've admitted. Right. You know? It is written,
and the look on his face is just utter boredom.
Yeah,
you know, like, can we just move past this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, sure. Yes, if that's what you want me to say, sure.
No, it's of little consequence to him, I think. And it was, like I say, it was clearly a sexual being, and his sexuality was evident in his life, and how it is transformed and distilled in his art and his craft, I think, is much more interesting, and how that's able to resonate with us. It's what he does with that that is so interesting. What he is or isn't, who cares, you know? He hid, you know, he was very good at hiding and disguising and bluffing, but there's something that Bowie's able to do, and I think only Bowie's able to do, which is to take that sexual, visceral energy and to transmute it into this force which grips you. It's not macho, it's not, you know, it's not the machismo of rock and roll. It's a very different kind of energy. And in relationship to that, people felt that he was talking to them and that they could be something else. This was what Bowie did. Bowie was like, you know, he was like Christ in the early period of the church. He wouldn't like that at all. But, you know, Christ was someone that saved people. He was this young, good-looking guy that saved people. And he wasn't this sort of, you know, person nailed to a tree. He was this young, good-looking guy with a kind of magic wand who saved people. And Bowie was someone that offered that. You know, he seemed to be offering a kind of rescue to pull you out of this place that you were told you were from.
Yeah.
You didn't feel you were from here. You just wound up with these people around you who claimed that they were your family.
Right.
In this hellhole of a place that you were living in. And Bowie offered something fantastically different.
Well, let's talk more about that in a second. But first, let's hear a little bit of Rock and Roll Suicide from the record Ziggy Stardust.
Oh, no, love, you're not alone. You're watching yourself, but you're so unfair. You got your head all tangled up, but if I can only make you care. Oh, no, love, you're not alone. No matter what or who you've been, no matter when or where you see.
David Bowie, Rock and Roll Suicide, Ziggy Stardust. Simon, this idea of transformation that you just spoke of, Bowie seemed to be giving people the possibility to transform.
Yeah, to reinvent.
To be who they wanted to be and, mm-hmm. and to resist limiting definitions.
Prevailing gender norms.
Yeah. And as you said, also gender and also class.
Yes. Working class boys putting on mascara. Working class heterosexual boys putting on mascara.
Right.
You know, what was that about? But Bowie enabled that. I mean, there's a lovely moment in the movie Closer about Ian Curtis.
Yeah.
Which I don't like that much. I rewatched it. It's better than I thought the first time. But it begins.
What's Did you good? Say Closer or Closer?
Closer, Closer. Well, they got that, you know, ambiguity with that.
I didn't realize that.
Well, yeah, I mean, two ways of thinking about that last Joy Division.
Uh-huh.
He was listening to...
Could be our next podcast.
He was listening to The Idiot.
Yes.
He was listening to The Idiot
right.
that was spinning on the turntable as he hanged himself. And you know, Ian Curtis was saturated in that period of Bowie, as we all were. But in that movie, he's depicted in loon pants, walking back from the record shop with a brown album, an album in a brown bag.
Yeah.
And it's a Bowie album. He takes it out and he's listening to it and he's cutting out clippings from the music press and he's putting on mascara in his... bedroom and he's sitting there with his friends, you know, smoking cigarettes in the bedroom, listening to Bowie. And it was just like that. And Bowie somehow unleashed something. It was a way of unleashing some kind of anxiety about class, certainly in England. And I mean, quite how he did it, I don't know, but it happened. And so for people like me and, you know, the people that I think of as my kind of core Bowie fan friends, It was like that.
Mm.
And nobody else did that. Roxy Music were great. You know, there were other great bands, but nobody had that kind of effect.
What about punk rock a few years later?
I mean, it was great, you know. I mean, it was great. Great to be alive and all of that. But in many ways, when punk kind of shakes itself, the first 6 months, 8 months... 12 months are gone, then you really realize that what it was about was Bowie.
Yeah.
Because all those bands are trying to sound like Bowie.
Yeah. Yeah.
The bands that end up as kind of Bauhaus and, you know, and Joy Division, and they're all... And Bowie was kind of the grid. There were other parts of the grid. There was Iggy, MC5, Velvet Underground. There was Roxy and all the rest. There were lots of other things. But Bowie was kind of the... He was the force. No one else came close.
Well, can we connect... this idea of transformation to love? Is real love, true love, whatever that is, does that always involve transformation? Is that the point of love?
Love is an exchange of nothings. Love is an exchange of nothings. Love has no, you know, there's no location in the brain. There's no, you can't find it. It's something which exists through... the giving of words and the receipt of words, you know, I love you, and it exists for as long as that exists, and then it can be betrayed very, very easily.
Yeah.
So love has this absolute fragility. It's this, and so I want to link the idea of love, the fragility of love, its evanescence, to Bowie's constant insistence on this image, this figure of nothing. The compilation that came out a couple of years ago, I'd just forgotten, it's called Nothing Has Changed. You know?
Yeah, I took that as just a joke.
Yeah, it is a joke. It's a joke. Nothing has changed. And, you know, but the flip side of that in the track Sunday is that everything has changed. And what Bowie, for me, did, and this is his kind of, if you like, the artistic rigor, the conceptual rigor of his practice, was to depict a world that had completely disintegrated, a world that had dissolved, that had become nothing, and in that world that had become nothing, to dredge from that the kind of nothing that is love, something like that. So for me, the kind of the consistently dystopian quality to Bowie's work is also linked to this appeal for something else.
Well, let me just read a little thing from the beginning of your Bowie book.
Mm.
You say, there's a view that some people call narrative identity. And this is the idea that one's life is a kind of story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And usually there's some early defining traumatic experience and a crisis or crises in the middle. Sex, drugs, any form of addiction will serve, from which one miraculously recovers. Such life stories usually culminate in redemption before ending with peace on earth and goodwill to all men.
Oh, the irony.
And the unity of one's life consists in the coherence of the story one can tell about oneself. People do this all the time. It's the lie that stands behind the idea of the memoir. And then you say, against this, I believe in decreative writing that moves through spirals of ever-ascending negations before reaching nothing.
Yeah.
In the piece
such,
you wrote...
Such a provocation.
In the piece you wrote in today's paper, you took a stand saying that Bowie's work doesn't end in nothing,
mm-hmm.
that it's not a negation, that it stands for something, and that something is love,
yeah,
connection.
No contradiction. I mean, not that a lot of what I say is contradictory, but in this case, strangely, no. It's the idea of decreation is the idea which I take from people like Simone Weil and other authors, the idea of undoing the creature in yourself, undoing the creaturely, undoing what you have received, what you've been given, tradition, custom, convention, all of that, stripping all of that away, undoing it, trying to reduce it to zero, to push it even further, to kind of hack and hew away at yourself. This is, I'm quoting Marguerite Perret, 13th century French mystic, to hack and hew away at yourself in order to make a space that's large enough for love to enter in.
Uh-huh.
So the uh-huh. negation, the kind of annihilation of everything that has previously existed is about opening a space that's a space for
it's about
for
breaking
love
down a wall.
This is where, I mean, to, you know, veer off, I don't know whether it's a veering off, but I think this is what Bowie's about. There's a religiosity here. It's a stripping away, it's a negation, which has always been what religion's about. You need to pull away from your traditional gods, you know, whatever that might be, money or tradition, to pull those things down, undo them in order to be open to the kind of demand that's a demand of, let's say, a loving God. Now, for Bowie, it's clear there was no loving God and no particular sympathy with any of the three monotheisms, all of which come in for a kind of hard time, particularly Christianity in Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there's a kind of religiosity in Bowie.
Sure.
An appeal that's more than plaintive and sentimental. And, you know, I guess in my wilder moments, I think of, you know, his musical practice as a kind of asceticism, a kind of austere practice, discipline almost. So maybe the 70s Bowie was about, you know, desire and pleasures and all of that. But the last 20 years of Bowie is much more of a kind of discipline, an artistic discipline of stripping away and of trying to maintain a space where what he does, his genius, can manifest itself.
After Heathen, he was talking about lamenting, really, what he saw as a lack of spirituality
yeah.
in everyday yeah. life.
The world is a world full of heathen. That's mm-hmm. why he calls that album Heathen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he lived in New York, which is the most heathen-ish place imaginable. And he must have loved it and hated it. It must have been kind of his backdrop for dystopia, certainly back in the 70s. But so this world is a world occupied by heathen. And whatever's going on, they're the insiders. And Bowie, who spoke to the outsiders, the alienated, what are all those people, his fans, were after something else. They were after a kind of, call it a spirituality, a religiosity, something else.
Mm.
It just meant that you didn't have to be heathen all the time.
Sure.
Whether this was intentional or not, I don't think it was intentional. I don't think he has that. I don't think anybody could have done this. But his disappearance over the last 10 years, mm-hmm. his absence, what that's created in people is an enormous, is not the fact that he's been forgotten, but on the contrary, it's created a kind of desire for him and made everything that he's done more kind of magical and transformative. So it's a kind of...
And himself. He understood that.
I don't know. I mean, I never met him. I never knew anyone that was close to him. Now I never will. Part of me likes to imagine that when Where Are We Now was released on his birthday, what, January the 8th, 2013, and then the album next day was announced, that I don't think he was sure at that point that this was going to find the echo that it found, that it was going to be as popular.
Yeah.
I think it must terrify every artist that they've been forgotten.
Yeah.
And I don't think Bowie was excluded from that. Black Star was a very different kind of operation, and the kind of preparation has been the build-up. And obviously what's happened is death. It's kind of difficult to even describe.
It is. So, well, some people, I'm sure, see Bowie as, you know, a succession of haircuts and outfits. Yeah. And also just as a pop star. But also a kind of shorthand for just non-normative behavior,
mm-hmm.
being different, being challenging, et cetera. But we're talking about him as having a real grid for thinking, a strategy for mm-hmm. understanding himself and the world.
And a medium, which was song.
Yeah. Where does this come from? Do you look at his work and his ideas, and say, well, yeah, that's, you know, one part Surrealist Manifesto,
mm-hmm.
one part R.D. Lang, one part et cetera?
No, I don't. I mean, so the idea of tracing it to, oh, he must have read Crowley. He clearly read Aleister Crowley. But everybody did read Crowley.
Yeah.
He read Nietzsche. There was some...
We do know what he read, by the way.
Yeah, we know...
Because of the list of 100 books.
Yes, and he was reading constantly. We know that. But I think it's more that... I saw the David Bowie Is show in London, which is largely about the costumes. And I saw it again in Chicago. And I get why he's so important in relation to fashion, and I don't want to diminish that, and the haircuts and all the clothes, and all, that's all very, very important. But for me, you know, if that didn't exist, I wouldn't really care. The songs are what?
Yeah.
The songs are the things. And I think that the old thing about Bowie, people always think about Bowie as this incredibly self-conscious, image-conscious, constantly changing figure, visual figure. In a sense, for me, it's a bit different. I think if Bowie had never appeared in public, he would have been a lot happier. He would have been happier maybe as a songwriter, as someone who would have just written songs or found a medium. Maybe he liked being in the studio. He liked writing songs. Mm-hmm. He really, really worked hard on producing this music. I find the reduction of him to a fashion icon, a series of outfits, a series of haircuts, a series of styles...
Sort of missing the point.
It misses the point. The point is in the songs.
Yeah.
And for me, you know, Bowie's the most important artist of the last half century. That's just the way it is for me. I'm not saying that's a valid judgment, but that's the way it is for me. And I put him, you know, in the same category as other people that I think are really great, like Wallace Stevens and Elizabeth Bishop and, you know, T.S. Eliot and people like that.
Yeah.
That what you have in Bowie, you can find sources, you can find origins for various things, but he produces a body of work, a body of musical work, musical poetry. It develops its own kind of style of imagery that echoes back and forth over the years, and it's him. I think it's... So we can find sources, things that he was reading, but the mistake is to reduce them to those sources.
Yeah.
He did something distinctive with those sources in the way that a poet would. A poet could read Nietzsche and mishear it in a certain way and do something amazing with it.
Sure.
I think it's what Bowie did. He made everything his own in some way that is difficult to find a recipe for. You know, the line, for some reason I'm speaking to you, I'm just thinking about that line that he said he liked from Joe the Lion, which is, "It's Monday. You slither down the greasy pipe, so far so good no one saw you. Up and over every freeway, you can be like your dreams tonight." There's a lot in that, but the line, "It's Monday." It's a brilliant kind of moment. Mm. What's the source for that? You know, well, there are days in the week, you know. Bowie had a complete kind of artistic self-consciousness, and that is something which other artists have had, let's say. But for a popular artist to have had it in such a sustained way for practically 50 years, it seems to me to be astonishing.
Well, let's hear a little bit from a different album, the title track from Aladdin Sane. That's David Bowie's Aladdin Sane with Mike Garson on piano.
Yeah, going a bit crazy.
A record that a lot of people I knew had in their collections when I was growing up. People who didn't have a lot of records, period. What a strange record for anybody to have, you know? Going through his work yesterday and trying to look for themes, which was incredibly easy to do. I found that just as we have been talking about how he wrote songs about middle states or exile or being here and not here or not quite having a home or whatever, he also made songs that would change course radically in the middle with no explanation and no apology. And Aladdin Sane, in a way, was like that. Although the same chords kept going on underneath. But, you know, the beginning of that song is fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
And then the second half is totally out to lunch.
The bass player just keeps on.
Yeah.
He keeps on going as the music.
Yeah.
Probably with a quite quizzical look on his face. Okay, how long is this going to go for?
It's
about 5.5 minutes, isn't it, that track?
And there's also Station to Station, which really is two songs in one. And
for me, that's a really key transitional moment in Bowie, Station to Station. The first, well, the whole thing, but the first 4 minutes, 33 seconds of it, that what he's got a pushing there. And there's a book by Hugo Wilkin on Low, which is, I think, a really good book. And he talks about how in Bowie, there's always a kind of point of articulation between one stage and the next.
Yeah.
So Diamond Dogs has got one track which has got a lot of wah-wah, kind of Isaac Hayes guitar in it, which prefigures Young American. Station to Station is he's twisting out of that aesthetic into what's going to happen in Low and Heroes. And that first 4 minutes of Station to Station is really where that's happening. You can see him twisting. And same with Aladdin Sane. You know, he'd just done, you know, he released Ziggy Stardust, The Spies from Mars, which took, what, 3 or 4 weeks to record after having worked for a year on Hunky Dory, which is the perfect album that everybody liked, does Ziggy Stardust really quickly. It's a huge hit. And then Aladdin Sane, he could have just done the same thing. And some of the tracks are, in a sense, he's riding his popularity, but he can't stop twisting the format. So Aladdin Sane, he's got that song structure and he's just kind of wrenching it and pulling it somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's what he always did.
And there's great power in it. He's saying, why not? Why not do this? This is a song. If I say it's a song, it's a song.
Yes. Maybe it's arrogance. I don't. But a complete conviction in Bowie about what he was doing. I mean, Tony Visconti said there's a quote from him about him. He just did what he wanted.
Yeah.
You know, there's something absolutely single-minded about what Bowie did. At the same time as he collaborated endlessly with people and he knew who to work with, and he was hugely dependent upon people like Mick Ronson and Carlos Alomar and the different arrangers he used over the years and producers. But there's a kind of willfulness about what he's up to.
Yeah.
Which is, it's amazing. And Black Star is, you know, I am going to die. And this is the message I'm going to send you, right?
Well,
saying no, but meaning yes.
Speaking of death, as if we can ever really speak about anything else. You know, there's Black Star, and then there's Ziggy Stardust, where he kills off the protagonist. But then there's lots of other examples of songs where he's talking about death.
Mm-hmm.
Diamond Dogs has some of them.
Candida ends with a suicide.
Candidate, yes. We Are the Dead.
We Are the Dead.
The song Quicksand has those lines, knowledge comes with death's release.
Knowledge comes with death's
release. If I don't explain what you ought to know, you can tell me all about it on the next Bardo.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about The Candidate.
It's one of those tracks that's easy to pass over because, I mean, Diamond Dogs is, it's still a kind of muddy production.
Yeah.
It's one of those muddy albums.
I find it hard to listen to.
A bit like, Iggy and the Stooges' Raw Power. It's not ever going to quite be clear enough.
Yeah.
But there we are. And Bowie plays guitar in it, which is good. But on the other hand, Mick Ronson would have been better. It's a concept album, right? And The Candidate...
It came from 1984, the Orwell book.
Yeah, he wanted to make a musical of 1984 and to put it on the stage in London or New York. Couldn't get the rights from the Orwell estate. That fell apart. At the same time, he did this interview, or Playboy or Rolling Stone, I forget which publication it was, brought Bowie together with William Burroughs.
Yeah.
He'd been reading Burroughs, but then he really gets
Rolling
into
Stone.
Burroughs. Yeah, Rolling Stone. And then he reads Wild Boys, Naked Lunch, things like that, and you've got all of that dystopian Burroughs stuff filtering into the lyrics of Diamond Dogs. And Candida is the depiction of a very, very bleak, disintegrated landscape, which is destroyed and at the same time a kind of film set. And that image you always often get in Bowie. It comes up in another one of my favorite tracks, Secret Life of Arabia. You must see the movie, The Sand in My Eyes. I walk through something where the heroine dies. So the idea of the world having disintegrated, it having the appearance of a film set, an unreality, and in that world, one figure or two figures appear. In this case, lovers who take drugs, listen to a band, and end it. A cheerful enough story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Simon, reading the piece that you wrote for The Times online, it made me wonder whether now that Bowie is dead and now that we understand his final work for what it was, is that going to change any of the things that you have been thinking about him? Is that going to change any of the conclusions about him that you came to when you wrote your book 2 years ago?
I think there's a kind of, a contradiction here. On the one hand, we've been saying, and I think we're right to say, that there's a continuity in Bowie's work, this kind of the rigor of this now body of work which stretches over 40 years. And it's always been about death. It's been one of his major preoccupations. So, and Black Star is, in a sense, nothing new. We can say that. But on the other hand, just experientially, in terms of how I felt between listening to Black Star on Saturday and Sunday and listen to Black Star on Monday, it feels like a different album.
Doesn't it?
I hear it differently. And particularly the tracks Dollar Days and I Can't Give Everything Away seem, again, like he's sending a message to me directly.
Yeah.
That he's gone.
It's not an open-ended question anymore.
I mean, when I saw the Bowie exhibition in London in 2013, David Bowie is, the thing that really hit me was that he was alive. He was alive and he was still making music. And because he was alive, we can be alive too. He will go on and we will go on. And we will go on. We will survive. We will, it will continue. What became increasingly important to me the last couple of years was now thinking about Bowie not as someone who died at 27 or who died later on, who faded out, but someone who kept going. He was sick. He wasn't sick. We didn't know. Now he's dead. That changes a lot. I mean, and then the question that it raises for me is how, and this sounds sloppy and sentimental, but, I feel it, is that how one then carries on. Now that Bowie's dead, what on earth does one do? The barrier that separated you, this the kind of cigarette paper, poorly chosen image that separated you from death has now been incinerated. It's now gone. And there you are. And so I find that Bowie was at some level company, even if he wasn't visible. He was there and he was doing something. And then eventually he would show it to us. There was an enormous kind of comfort in that. With his death, that has changed now. Bowie's music will now have to make a different kind of sense, it seems to me. What that will be, we will see. But listening to Black Star last night over and over again as I was, it really sounded like I was a kind of a seance, and the table had rattled, yeah. And you know, yeah. Someone was speaking from beyond the grave.
Yeah.
It felt really spooky.
Yeah.
And the Lazarus video in particular, where he's, you know, he's got the face coverings of Lazarus, he disappears into a cupboard at the end. It just seems like such a message. Now, what one can say in relationship to that is that, God, this is the best death. This is the best death anyone can have. Here was Bowie, who was an artist and all the things that we've said. He releases a killer album and he dies 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And what could be more perfect than that? So maybe, you know, we finally have an example of the good death. Maybe that's what we should take away from this.
Well, Simon, thank you. You can read Simon Critchley's piece on the New York Times website, and you can also read Simon Critchley's book on Bowie called Bowie, published in 2014. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much, Ben.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. We love you.
That's our show, and thanks for listening. You can read Simon Critchley's essay, which is called Nothing Remains, David Bowie's Vision of Love, at nytimes.com/opinionator. Our engineer is Pedro Rosado, and our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. And you can read our coverage of David Bowie over the last couple of days at nytimes.com/music. Thanks for listening.